Please be seated. So I think it's an interesting and slightly comic coincidence that on this day when our ministry fair is being held, and especially when we are on the cusp of beginning our Sunday school year and we are sort of reaching out to families, we have this text today. Jesus saying, unless you hate mother, father, brother, sister, wife, children, and even your own life, you can't be my disciple. And I think Jesus is probably saying something a little more than what we understand hate to be, and I'm going to get to that. And I want to talk primarily about this gospel text and a little bit about Ecclesiastes. But I want to start with what I often sort of comically refer to as Christian family values. And we know that's part of sort of our culture wars, and people are adamant about defending what they perceive to be Christian family values. But really, when you look at the New Testament, Christian family values are a little perplexing. You start with Paul, the earliest, and he says, oh man, don't. If you can do anything to avoid getting married, do. I mean, if it's the last option, go ahead, but almost anything is better. Okay, so that's a left jab and a right cross to family values. And then Jesus comes along and says, you know, your foes are going to be those of your own household. Do you think I come to bring peace, not peace with a sword? Set father against son. If anyone comes to me without hating father, mother, brother, sister, can't be my disciple. So, again, I think Jesus, in all instances, everywhere and all the time, is ultimately counseling us to love. But he is also constantly alerting us to what we think is love and may not be. And family is one of those things. Family is one of those things that is a complex and almost determinative experience. I mean, I spent much of my life as a therapist, and in the 20th century, a whole industry has grown up around people trying to come to some understanding of what their family experience meant and how not to just live out the patterns of their families. Even if they try not to, we all try not to, and we find ourselves doing it without being able to control it. And I think Jesus is really quite deeply in touch with the kind of power our families have over us. And one of the ways, this sounds a little bit comic, and yet I really mean it very seriously. One of the ways I've thought about our families for a long time has to do with church, and it actually has to do with ordination. And you know how much time the church has spent arguing and insisting that the only valid ordination is that which comes from the Roman Catholic Church, and it depends upon an unbroken line of apostolic succession, laying on of hands to the newly ordained from earliest times until now. And it's meant by that laying on of hands and that ordination to perpetuate a tradition. Not many of us are ordained within the church. What I would suggest is that all of us are ordained within our families. And that that a family gets you for about 18 years. And during that 18 years, they are constantly drumming into you this. Here's what we think is normal. Here's the way we do things. Here's what we think is important. Here's what we think is fearful. This is what we worry about. And, you know, and 18 years isn't really enough. But at the end, you go, okay, now go out and perpetuate our tradition. We're all ordained into that family reality. And the family reality is complex. I mean, the shorthand way to say it is families are as sinful as anything else. You know, we have limited perspective. We have self-interest. We have fear. We have sort of unanalyzed, unreflected upon desire. We've got the whole mix of our human problems right there in the family. And so the family itself presents significant challenges to our understanding of what love is. And it's not always easy to discover oneself and one's own capacity to love within the family. And often what seems to be required is to give up some relationship to the family that you might get it back again. Which is, as it turns out, exactly what Jesus says. He says, you know, Peter comes to him and says, Lord, we've given up everything for you. We've given up everything, father, mother. And Jesus says, anybody who gives up what I'm asking you to give up, and in the way I'm asking you to give up, will not experience deprivation. It's not loss. You give it up and you get it back. Not just what you gave up, you get it back hundredfold. Which is to say, whatever kind of renunciation Jesus is talking about is not meant to cut us off, alienate us, turn us into those people who, you know, I mean, are there teenagers? Wow, Jesus is telling me to hate my mother and father. Wow, that's great. Not doing that. We're not doing that. I'm looking at some teenagers out there. A few of you. We're not doing that. What Jesus is talking about is a change in relationship, a giving up that you might get it back. So, what is Jesus talking about? You've got this very powerful language, hate. Hate mother, hate father, hate brother, hate sister, hate children, hate life. The Greek word is complex because where it's used elsewhere in the New Testament, it sort of means what we conventionally think of as hate. The Aramaic, which of course Jesus spoke, and the oral tradition sort of came through the Aramaic into the Greek. And the Aramaic may have meant something a little less provocative. This word means to set aside. So to set aside your allegiance to mother, father, brother, sister, that a higher allegiance might take its place. But even so, I don't think we need to resort to word studies to make the case that Jesus is not telling us to hate. He's telling us that you've got to examine your life and figure out what is the most important thing. And that important, and you've got to figure that out. And not everything that presents itself as ultimately important is actually ultimately important. I think we are very familiar with what Jesus is talking about today. You can't be my disciple unless you consider all of these profound relationships you have as relatively unimportant compared to what I'm calling you into. And I think we know what Jesus is talking about at least in two ways, and maybe others. First, romantic love. Our culture lives on stories of romantic love. And romantic love often has a story of somebody having to give up something for the sake of the beloved. They enter into disgrace, they leave their family, they are disinherited by their father because they've made an unappealing match. Wallace Simpson and King Edward VIII, and he abdicated. How often have we heard stories of the lover saying to the beloved, I've given up everything for you. I'm not going to try to get into the complexities of romantic love. I'm just saying, we know that story. We know what it's like for people to believe that it's worth giving up things in order to enter into something else. And then the second place we know it very well is in war, and the life of the soldier. The soldier the government is essentially saying to the young man or woman who is about to enter into service exactly what Jesus is saying. You have to consider the work we are calling to you as more important than anything else. So important that it's worth you dying for. We believe that the work we are doing politically and militarily is so important that we do not shrink from asking you to give up your life to support it. I mean, this is what Jesus is saying. Only there's a difference between what the military called soldiers into and what Jesus was calling his disciples into. But the conditions are much the same. All I'm trying to do is sort of help us realize that what Jesus is talking about, though the language is kind of jarring to our ears, it's not unfamiliar. We all know what it's like to be called into something that may actually cost us our lives. I sort of put romantic love to one side, and I will put the legitimacy of governments to one side as well, and whether the question of whether they can legitimately ask citizens to give up their lives for their purposes. It's an ongoing question. And I don't mean to raise it rhetorically. It's a real question, and it is a source of great moral and spiritual anguish to figure out how to live in the world and how to contend with evil and whether violence is the right way to go about it. Nonetheless, soldiers get invited into exactly the same kind of dynamic that Jesus was talking about. So what's Jesus' project? I think, again, fairly simple. The project of Jesus is the project of love. What it's like really to be a person loving in the world. And so Jesus is in a sense saying, do you want to love? Do you want to be capable of loving? Well, here are the conditions. And he says, you know how to plan and sort of anticipate what something is going to require of you. If you're going to build a tower or a house, get your financing, you get your materials, you get your builders, and you try to see it through to the end. Or if you're going to war, you kind of evaluate if you're going to be able to do it. And so Jesus is saying, well, my project, what it requires of you is you have to give up all your possessions. And again, this is a difficult thing. Many people espouse biblical literalism, but when you ask them, well, have you given up all your possessions? Rarely. What I think Jesus is talking about, and again, I'm sure I've said this a few times before, what Jesus is talking about when he says you have to give up all your possessions is not that possessing things is wrong. And it's not that you're forbidden to possess things. It's that possessing things is impossible. That fundamentally, everything or every time we think of our relationship to the world as one of possession, we are indulging in an illusion. It's not that we are not supposed to possess things, it's that we can't. We can't really, whatever it is that possessing intends, this is mine, and I'm going to hang on to it. The truth is, we can't. We can't hang on to anything. And that's why I substituted Ecclesiastes today for Jeremiah, because I think Ecclesiastes, and just, go home and read that book. It's very short, and it's an interesting book. But I think it really is the story of exactly the self that Jesus is describing, that is sort of in that relationship of possessing things, and that self is reflecting on it and saying, wow, is this weary? Day after day, I work, but then I'm going to die, and somebody else is going to get it. Nothing really new, and what I want, I think I get, but I can't hang on to it. Everything just is taken away from me. Ecclesiastes, the weariness of the self that thinks of itself as possessing things. And in the end, it is I would speak of it as a huge liberation, as if I actually had experienced that for myself. I've glimpsed it. I see a little bit of what it's like no longer to consider myself as one who possesses things. And of course, it's not just things that we possess. We also possess each other. And we are very acquisitive and very possessive in our relations to each other. And whether it's things or people or land or anything, it's just an illusion. We don't possess. And you know that great line that, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. bonus points, those who can identify those two songs. But I mean, the songs they point to something. When you've got something to lose, and you're going to hold back. And what Jesus is saying is, you can't hold back. Every moment is all in. You're all in. And to love and to be a loving person, that's my cause. And it's not easy, and it will be volatile, and it may even cost you your life. And do you understand that the cause of love in the world, that cause is truly worth your life? Many other causes may not be, but this cause is worth your life. And, you know, Jesus was writing in first century Palestine, and crosses lined the road, and death, I think, perhaps was more proximate than it is now for many of us. But nonetheless, we misapprehend love quite deeply if we think of it as just a kind of a nice, sentimental, let's be nice with each other. Love is hugely disruptive. I mean, it didn't exactly cost him his life, but, you know, we're working toward at least a beginning of Nelson Mandela, starting with an examination of his life to look at the power of love and forgiveness. And, you think of people who have spoken the truth in love in the world and how often it has cost them their lives. We underestimate love if we think of it as just a safe, sort of soothing thing. What it does is it unmasks the world. It reveals the untruthfulness of the world. It reveals the very things that those who have power don't want to be revealed. Or nearer to home, think of what it's like to try to speak the truth in love around the Thanksgiving dinner table. You know, when there are things in your families that have been vexing your families for generations and for generations, and how hard it is to talk about them, how hard it is within a family context to speak the truth in love without provoking reactions of fear and defensiveness and people with something to protect, people that feel they're being accused of something, people that feel they're being made vulnerable. You can't really, it's hard to work around that. The necessity for doing so is inescapable if we want to be people of love. And so, I don't know, what Jesus is calling us into is, I believe, for my money, the only project in our human experience that legitimately asks us to consider giving up our lives. And at least imaginatively and spiritually within our own hearts, even if we're not asked to give up our lives physically, we are asked to give up our understanding of ourselves as constituted by possessing things. Only there will we find the freedom to love unreservedly without anything held back. And for Jesus, that's the only thing worth doing. It's it.